The hour of 8:30 having arrived, I'm going to call to order state and local government operations, reform, technology, and elections. Representative Nelson, I believe there's a division report on House File 17.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the division report.
Representative Nelson moves the division report. Do we have a quorum? Oh, we do have a quorum. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Representative Nelson, you want to move?
I'll move House File 17.
17. And it's going to go to taxes.
The office to move to taxes, yeah.
All right. Representative Sertich, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee. I have before you House File 17 that deals with a central firing range sanitary sewer district. History on why this bill is here, members, is this district joint services was originally passed back in 2003 and amended subsequently. The communities had to pass resolutions to the Secretary of State to incorporate and make these changes. At the time, there was a clerical error, and the communities passed resolutions of support for the clerical changes, but not the underlying district. And once this was figured out, they then subsequently attempted to send these changes in, and one of the communities missed the deadline literally by one day. So it's back before us to reincorporate this district. There are two changes, though, as the discussion has changed in the past 5 years. The two changes to the previous bills deal with provisions that allow these communities, these five entities, to either opt in and opt out after a master plan is agreed to, and also provides the opportunity for these communities to have referenda to get out of the district as well, to give more local support to the bill. Mr. Chair, I have resolutions of support from the communities, and I'm open for any questions.
Any discussion to the bill? Anyone wish to testify for or against the bill? Seeing none, Representative Nelson will renew his motion that House File 17 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Tax Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
We're going to go down to Representative Murrow. He's got a testifier that has to get back. So, Representative Murrow to Senate File 275.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I would move that Senate File 275 be recommended to pass and move to the General Register.
All right. See your motion, and then you have someone that wishes to testify, or do you want to go through the bill first?
Well, Mr. Chair, members, the bill is very quick. I have with me Dr. Tanis Fisher from the Water Resources Center and Minnesota River Board. Dr. Fisher needs to teach a class at MSU, Mankato at 11, so I appreciate the Chair and Representative Hilty allowing Dr. Fisher to present. But, Mr. Chair, the bill is quite simple. It renames the Minnesota River Basin Joint Powers Board to be the Minnesota River Board, clarifies the duties of the board, and revises the composition and duties of the advisory committee. And I'll turn to Dr. Fisher if he has anything to add.
Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you. My name is Shannon Fisher. I am the Executive Director of the Minnesota River Board and also the Director of the Water Resources Center at Minnesota State University, Mankato. I believe Representative Morrow summarized quickly the changes in the bill. There had been some questions over the last few years regarding the bill or the language, the statute language that has created the Minnesota River Board and what our duties are. And at the request of many of our stakeholders and some of our delegates, we wanted to clarify some of those in this bill. And particularly, there was new language added to clarify the role of a technical advisory committee, and I believe that this will help us better establish that committee and move that committee forward to help the delegates of the board bring forth better policy decisions and better discussion regarding water quality improvements in the Minnesota River Basin. I don't really have a whole lot of additional information to add other than the self-explanatory pieces in the bill, but I thought I wanted to be here today to see if there were any questions, if I could answer anything or provide any additional information. So that's about all I have.
A discussion to the bill. President Biskin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Morrow on page 3, line 27, the establishment of the advisory committee. What rules will govern that advisory committee?
Representative Merrill.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, did you get Representative Biskin's which role, what role would it play?
Yeah,
Representative Biskin.
Thank you. No, I understand the role. What rules will govern the advisory committee? Is this an all-volunteer committee? Is there going to be compensation for serving on the advisory committee, et cetera?
Mr. Fisher, do you want to respond to that?
Yes, thank you. The committee will be initially appointed, at least a small advisory team would be appointed by the Minnesota River Board delegates, which are all county commissioners. But one thing that is different from this board compared to technical advisory committees that we've attempted to do in the past is that they will be largely self-governed and independent. And our intentions here are to provide them with the support services and the finances that they need to get this technical group going. We would appoint a couple of people to kind of initiate the planning process. But then we largely want this group to dictate their own structure and their own governance. And what we anticipate here, though, is volunteer opportunities. We're hoping that the board will remain to be financed through the state legislature and county funds so that we can at least provide them with facilities, possibly some travel stipends and others to participate. But it will all be funding dependent.
Mr. Chair, I just do want to share a concern that it sounds like we're creating layer upon layer upon layer. I thought the Minnesota River Board was meant to be an advisory board to the legislature, and now it sounds like we need to make another committee to be an advisory committee to that committee. It sounds a little convoluted, Mr. Chair.
Representative Gutwell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Morrow, as I'm looking at Subdivision 1, the first part, under the first part, line 1.7 through 1.13, I notice you've taken out the term by the year 2005 and inserted what is basically, I believe, a mission statement of the board. And my concern about removing the date is, did we achieve the goal? 2005 obviously is, 4 years in the past, but how are we doing with coming towards the goal, and should we not have some sort of time frame in there by which we're trying to achieve something?
Representative Morrow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, for Godwell. Well, I think in part the Minnesota River Board has been talking about how to alter or transform itself. In part, I don't believe that it met the goal by 2005. I wasn't here in 2005, but I certainly was along the Minnesota River, and fishing and swimming was not an activity, at least in our area, one did a great deal. But I'll turn to Dr. Fisher to expand upon that.
Dr. Fisher.
Thank you. The original goal of making the river fishable and swimmable by 2005 was, a great aspiration. And the reality of that just simply wasn't very good. Progress has been made. The annual State of the Minnesota River Report, which is funded by MPCA and produced by the Water Resource Center, we are showing that there are some signs of improvement. There are slight increases or improvements in some of the water quality parameters. We are seeing some of the socioeconomic benefits of improvements in the river. We see more people fishing on the river than we've seen in probably more than a decade. There's also some anecdotal evidence, such as we are seeing more and more reports all the time now about paddlefish and blue suckers and various darter species being present in the river. And these would be indicator species that would suggest that things are moving in the right direction. But we felt it was important to kind of remove the end date. I mean, in reality, if we wanted to put a date on that, I think it would be, even from today, it would be considerably out there in the future. This river was under a serious state of degradation for a century. And I think to think we can fix it in a decade is not realistic.
All right. Further discussion. Anyone else wish to testify? All right. Seeing none, Representative Merle.
I renew my motion, Mr. Chair.
All those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Thank you. Representative Hilty, House File 1744. Hilty, I believe finance would like to see your bill. So Why don't you make the initial motion?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move that House File 1744 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Finance. And, Mr. Chair, that should, I believe, be with the further recommendation that it be referred to the State Finance Division.
And, Mr. Hilty, there, I have two amendments here. Do we need to put those on before you proceed?
Mr. Chair, the shorter of the two amendments is the author's amendment that clearly clarifies something that was a concern for the Department of Administration. The more substantive amendment is not mine. I don't know.
So do you want to make it up and
healthy? I would move the... they seem to be numbered the same, so I don't know how to distinguish.
All right, I'm going to go with the A1 amendment that is page 2, line 24, after measures insert, if applicable, and then I don't know what we're going to do with the second one, but we may make that A2 just for
very well
clarification. So let's move the A1. Any discussion to the A1 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Hilty, two-year bill as amended.
Mr. Chair and members, what House File 1744 does is ask the it requires the state through the Department of Administration to set accessibility standards for state software and hardware and websites. Currently, members, the state has not set the accessibility standards, and this has resulted in many Minnesotans, particularly those who are deaf, deaf-blind, blind and hard of hearing, to be unable to access websites and products produced by the state. It's actually about 10% of the population. For instance, a review made of the Minnesota Management and Budget site shows that we do not have this language adopted in contracts. Members, there are a number of testifiers. I will run through the bill briefly and then try to save most of the time for the numerous people that wish to address the bill. Basically, what the bill does is add the requirement for accessibility to the criteria used in contracts and purchases by the Department of Administration. I think this committee would be particularly interested in Section 4, which requires the Commissioner of the Department of Administration to establish rules regarding technology access standards applicable to technology software and hardware procurement, and then in Section 12, the establishment of an advisory committee for technology standards for accessibility and usability, and membership is described there. This bill does have the financial implications that will be addressed in the State Government Finance Committee and also in my committee, where the account that is being drawn upon for funding this bill resides. Mr. Chair, with that, I would, if it's your pleasure, just go through testimony, beginning with Representative Westrom.
All right. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself.
Mr. Chair, Representative Tory Westrom, members, I signed on to this bill and have been asked by the authors and those that are in support of it to to offer some testimony of real life experience, and that's what I'm here to do, to urge our committee in the House to adopt this bill. I urged the Senate committees last week to adopt this bill. In 1987, I lost my eyesight in a car accident, and certainly have had an experience of trying to find alternative and adaptive ways to accomplish similar tasks as before. What I've got in front of me here today is what they call a slate and stylus. Here's the slate, here's the stylus. Now, how it works is this little sharp end with a piece of paper inside of here. You would go and you can make braille marks and write notes. Now, decades ago, that is literally how people took notes and wrote and made adaptive writings that they were trying to read, or they would use it to write stuff, letters, etc., etc. Certainly today we have progressed. In 1987 or 1988, when I received my first computer, we bought it. My parents, our church had, and local Lions Club had several fundraisers. There was speech software that was just coming out. That speech output software was the size of a briefcase, and it sat on top of my other desktop. Today, that same speech software comes on a disk or a CD and loads into my laptop computer, just to demonstrate how that has progressed. So my point in bringing this to you is, first of all, we are not talking about hiring somebody to use a slate and stylus to make all the items accessible. With the electronic age we are in and the softwares that are out there, the accessibility softwares, I currently use the speech software. Many of you will see me in committees and on the floor with a headset on my computer. It's because the computer is talking to me, telling me what I am reading, reading the emails, reading the Word documents, reading the bills and legislation. So that is what we are talking about, trying to set standards for. Graphics are a tough thing for speech to recognize. A picture is hard to explain unless they've properly identified it on the website. And there are ways and standards and websites for the programmers to label, what they call label, those graphics and icons on websites. There's navigability standards, and there's easier ways to make a website navigable. In past, there's been times I've raised some stink with the Rules Committee, both under Republican control and Democrat control, in that it's a common sense solution in that we are buying the software upgrades year in and year out. We're buying original softwares, and I have said for a long time, all they have to do is require the vendor to make sure it's accessible up front, period. We don't have to have our tech personnel running around here spending hours and days trying to figure out how it becomes accessible. GroupWise, for instance, members, is a mess to work with on accessible speech. It has gotten a lot better over the 13 years I have been here, but our tech support staff can verify that for many years we've had to. There was a period of time where I couldn't even upgrade because the newer versions of GroupWise weren't compatible with the JAWS speech that I used. I still have a function on my computer. I have to shut the speech off after it's been turned on and then turn it back on, just because there's still a bug in the system that nobody can seem to figure out why the JAWS speech isn't working with GroupWise. Well, folks, I submit, had that been a request up front, and more states going to the standard, the software developers are going to start doing a better job, and they have already, communicating with the company Freedom Scientific, which makes the JAWS speech, or other companies like that up front, and saying, here's what's coming out. Why don't you start working on this? Several years ago, I was told they basically waited until the release before the adaptive speech or technicians could get their hands on it, and then 6 or 12 or 18 months later, they could come out with an adaptive system to their software. They are getting better at, from reports I've heard, that they will start contracting with these adaptive software techs ahead of time and giving them insight into what changes they are making so they can start releasing updates at a similar time, so adaptive software is more coincides with the release. So the pressure and the common sense of making that on the front end, I think, is immense. And there are standards out there, and so I stand here to suggest to you this doesn't have to be a costly measure. It just has to be a procedure that we start adopting on the front end rather than afterwards then asking, oh, how do we make this accessible for those that need accessible speech? It isn't a rocket science to those that are in the field. It's just a process that needs to be implemented up front. Lastly, Mr. Chair, the court systems. We have a lot of long ways to go to upgrade those. In my private life, I'm also a lawyer. When I go to the Court of Appeals to research, all those briefs, they're awfully very thick, are all coming in paper. And I have asked for years and suggested to the courts, why don't we make them accessible? I just had that conversation with the courts a few weeks ago. Again, they said, well, we are going to work on that. Well, what I submit is any of law firms that are submitting those briefs by typewriter could be exempt from this new policy, but those that are not using typewriters anymore could send those documents in a Word format or a electronic format that is likely where all, if not all, nearly all of them are being crafted from in the first place. And so it's just a matter of going back and getting those people to submit them electronically in the first place. There may be some other side benefits, and I think many law firms, many persons in the community that would be using or wanting to read those certainly would like to see them electronic as well. And so it's not just an accessibility or a disability issue, it's a 21st century issue, and this might be the impetus that gets that accomplished. And so, Mr. Chair, I think that would be another net effect, a positive effect that would come out of this, is the courts and all of our state agencies would be pushed to find these models and accessibility standards, and therefore I strongly support this legislation and would urge the committee to do as well.
Thank you, Representative Western. Question. Representative Dutwall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hilty, appreciate you bringing this bill forward. Representative Western, appreciate your testimony. I had just one question, excuse me, on page 8 and on page 9B. Advisory committee. I'm not fine. Who appoints the advisory committee members? I see the listing of members and the duties. There's some reference to the appointing authorities on line 9.26. But who actually appoints this advisory committee?
Representative Hilton.
Mr. Chair, if we're going to get into questions regarding the advisory committee, I would like to call on Ms. Hartnett to help us discuss the rationale for the committee and its membership.
Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, my name is Mary Hartnett. I'm with the Commission of Deaf, Deafblind, and Hard of Hearing Minnesotans. And there may be, the intent was actually to have the Office of Enterprise Technology appoint.
I believe Mr. Shepard can clarify. Mr. Shepard.
Mr. Chair, members, Representative Gottwald, in each of the 9 clauses in that advisory committee, there's a different appointing authority, I think. For example, Clause 1, the Chief Information Officer of OEP would appoint that person. Clause 2, a representative from State Services of the Blind would be appointed by the Commissioner. and so on. Each one of them has a different, most of them are designees of an executive commissioner, but they're each different, and they're each specified in each individual clause.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, maybe Ms. Hartnett can touch on this, because as I look at the duties of the advisory committee and then turn back and look at the duties of the chief information officer, CIO, the Maytag repairman of state government, because it looks like that's his job, all right? As we have the duties here, it looks like that's what he's supposed to do. As I look at the membership here, you know, I think the chief information officer could go ahead and convene this group with these people. I'm not sure we have to write it in the statute, so help me understand why we have to write it in the statute.
Ms. Hart.
Mr. Chair and Representative Biskins, actually, this is an existing group. If you look in your handouts, page 2, there's the usability and accessibility team. This is actually giving that team, which is trying to go for voluntary adoption of the standards unsuccessfully, to put this team into place for 2 years. It's a 2 year the statute of limitations, and they will then meet to perform all of the duties that are listed and then report back to the legislature and then draw from 508, which basically says that you should try to provide the maximum amount of accessibility without causing an undue burden to the state, and then that group will be within its duties making recommendations to the commissioner. There are all people that are listed in this area, actually people that are already serving, but haven't had the authority to be able to advise, and for those accessibility standards and guidelines to be adopted.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Representative Hilty, and especially in hearing the testimony from Representative Westrom. I think the realization sometimes of what the challenges that you have to deal with in these situations are just astronomical, and you don't want to wait to be there to understand and know how important this is. I think the other thing is that the volunteer, I think these folks have really made a good effort, but if there's one thing we've experienced is that we don't have the experience that they have. Only if you're in these situations do you truly understand. And I think the CIO is great on technology and of a tremendous value, certainly can do some of these things, but you must have these folks sitting at the table giving that personal input to this. This is not something that we can just understand. And so I think in this particular case, if there's any ever a place for an advisory team that is really essential to the technology and to the functioning, I think this one would be it, and so I would speak strongly in support of it.
Okay. Representative Hilty, I do have 6 people that you've listed that wish to testify.
Sure, I was just going to mention that.
All right, then let's proceed. I have next Sean, is it Verdig? Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Sean Vernig, and I'm here today as a private citizen. I'm a licensed school administrator, a volunteer with the Commission of Deaf, Deafblind, Hard of Hearing, and also the founder and owner of a startup bicycle company. I'm here to express my support of House File 1744. I'd like to thank Representative Hilty for agreeing to be the chief author of this important legislation. I strive to be a good citizen. I encourage my students I serve to be engaged in the legislative process. I encourage them to visit the legislative website. While the site is very navigable for screen readers, none of the video and audio committee hearings are captioned. Overall, a very small percentage of video or multimedia contents on state websites has been captioned. The Supreme Court website videos are not captioned, and there are no scripts for audio podcasts. The Internet has the potential to revolutionize disability access to information, as evidenced by my active involvement with both my career in educational administration and my startup, Rolland Cycles. any obstacles along the way that restrict this potential can leave people with disabilities discouraged and unable to reap the benefits that e-government has to offer. By adopting these national standards, we can take a big step toward overcoming these barriers. Each of the major categories of disabilities requires certain types of adaptations in the design of the web content. Most of the time, these adaptations benefit nearly everyone, not just people with disabilities. Almost everyone benefits from helpful illustrations, properly organized content, and clear navigation. Similarly, while captions are a necessity for deaf and hard of hearing citizens, they can be helpful to others, including anyone who views a video without audio and people who use English as a second language. The WCAG has three levels of access, A, AA, and AAA. The funds that are proposed in the legislation would give funds to coordinate the advisory committee, to provide pilot funds for captioning of online committee hearings and floor sessions, and provide some web content in American Sign Language. Mr. Chair and members, I really urge you to adopt these standards and support this bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions? All right. Thank you very much. Jamie Taylor.
Mr. Chair, in the interest of time, Jamie is not going to testify, and we're going to move to the next testifier.
All right. Jennifer Dunham? Jennifer? Don't see Jennifer. How about Chris Bell? If we get a page to... We'll get a page to help you. Right around.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Christopher Bell, and I am the chair of the Advocacy and Legislation Committee of the American Council of the Blind in Minnesota. I'm pleased to be here in support of this very important bill, and like Representative Westrum, my group is comprised almost exclusively of people who are totally blind or severely visually impaired, and many of us try to access the internet for information. And many sites, including state websites, are not accessible to us. Now, it's hard for people that don't have a disability to recognize that in life, stuff happens. Representative Western mentioned that he lost his sight in an auto accident 1987, a very important leader in the deaf community, I. King Jordan, lost his hearing in a motorcycle accident. And today, we're all knowledgeable about the aging of our society, particularly of the baby boom generation. Now, currently, people 55 years of age and over account for about 12% of our population. It's expected that by 2030, I believe it is, that percentage will increase to 21% of the population. I mention this because it is part of the aging process that many people will incur functional limitations as they get older. Hearing issues, vision issues such as macular degeneration, which is the greatest cause of blindness in our country, mobility impairments. It's part of the aging process. It doesn't happen to everybody, but it happens to more and more of us the older we get. Now, in our generation, we have learned to use computers for information, and in the succeeding decades, of course, that will be even more important. So it's critical, given the important information that the state makes available to the public through the internet, and that will certainly increase, that we prepare now not only to make this important data source accessible for people with disabilities today, but for the increasing number of people with disabilities in the coming decades. So this bill is a great place to start, and I heartily endorse it. Thank you very much.
All right. Questions? Seeing no questions, thank you, Mr. Bell. We'll get a page to help you again, too.
Thanks, so.
I've got Steve Jacobson next. Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
My name is Steve Jacobson. I am the Vice President of the National Federation of the Blind of Minnesota, and I'm also speaking on behalf of Jennifer Dunham. I also serve as the Vice President of our National Computer Science Division and have been employed for 30 years as a computer analyst in private industry. In the late 1990s, the National Federation of the Blind of Minnesota was active in getting the first Access to Technology bill passed. We saw the beginnings of a real problem then. Blind persons, and that's the area I'm most familiar with, so that's what I'm going to address. Blind persons were being excluded from jobs, not because we couldn't perform the job functions, but rather because the technology that was chosen made the jobs impossible to perform. There were options that could have been exercised at the time that would have made it possible for us to perform the necessary duties of the job. Now that 10 years have passed, we have a better sense of where technology is going, and the tools that we have to use technology are more mature. It therefore seems appropriate to take a second look at how technology purchased by the state of Minnesota can impact blind persons and other disabled persons in a positive way. A question that was asked 10 years ago and is probably on most of your minds today is whether the Americans with Disabilities Act already covers this. Also, cost is a concern to everyone this year in particular. I'd like to take a look at both of those topics in the next minute or two. If the capability of technology to be used by blind persons is considered when the requirement for such software are being defined, the costs are insignificant or even non-existent. It must be understood that we are not addressing talking or braille output to computers in this law. Rather, we are asking that software that is purchased by the state of Minnesota is compatible with technology that we are already using as blind computer users. For example, blind persons now commonly use Windows, XP, and Vista. We use Microsoft Word and Excel. We use Internet Explorer and Firefox. We use Eudora and Outlook Express and countless other applications that each of you use every day. Companies such as Lexmark and Hewlett-Packard are addressing some of the difficulties we have with multifunction devices like printer, copier, and faxes by providing accessible web interfaces to some of these devices so that we can get at them. It's worth noting that the labeling of graphics that Representative Westrum refers to is possible not because somebody put that in for blind persons, but because there is a need for people using slow internet connections to be able to see what images they had opted not to download. Sometimes it says, click on a mailbox to see your mail. Well, if the mailbox isn't there because you have a low bandwidth connection, you need a label there so you know what to do. We can exploit that something that already exists to help us out. If private industry sees that their products must be accessible by blind persons and other disabled persons to be purchased by government, the choice of software to be purchased will become easier, and this is already happening. What if accessibility is not part of the planning process? The chances are very good that the Americans with Disabilities Act and other state and federal laws could be interpreted to require the state to retrofit systems. Having been involved in such cases myself, I know that the cost of paying lawyers and responding quickly to a decision that upholds such laws is both expensive and disruptive. The cost of not planning will almost certainly be a great deal higher, and the results will be less effective. The importance of accessibility in the world of technology is much more visible now than it was 10 years ago. Therefore, there are now clear standards and paths to follow, and there are federal guidelines and standards that can be leveraged today. If access to technology purchased by the state of Minnesota for disabled persons is considered before development or purchase, the costs will be much lower and would be, sorry, this is nerve-wracking. The cost will be much lower and the results will be much more effective and than it would be if we wait for an ADA violation to take place. In addition, more of us will find employment and people will become taxpayers. The effect of this approach will also positively impact the ability for us to get jobs within the private sector where many of the same software and technologies are used. Therefore, please help us move this bill forward. Thank you. Any questions? Representative Kalin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Jacobson. I want to thank you for laying out or answering a question I had in my head, which is the relationship with the Americans with Disabilities Act. And I just want to highlight for members, when I was in architecture school, one of the things that one of my professors was one of the founding implementers and interpreters of the ADA, and often said that we are born needing help and we end our close our lives needing help, and some of us are fortunate enough not to need as much help in the middle of our lives. And the infrastructure of making doorways accessible and curb cuts was made much more cost-effective by having one uniform standard that designers need not actually make up their own standards, but actually could pull it off the shelf and make it work. As we build our digital infrastructure, I think it's really critical that we have one standard so that it is cost-effective for us, and so that we are accessing all the talent of the people in our community who need just a little bit more help than we do, who have are lucky enough to not need as much help during the middle of our lives. And so, Mr. Jacobson, I want to thank you for raising that point about the next level of infrastructure as we build it up to have a uniform standard.
Next, I have John Lally. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chairman and members, my name is John Lally. I'm the planning director of the Office of Enterprise Technology, and I appreciate the opportunity to comment on this. I think Representative Westrum and the other witnesses that have testified so far have made our case for many of the reasons why this is an important thing to be pursued. And I want the committee to understand that we endorse the intent of this bill and believe that more than probably anybody but these witnesses, we understand the transformative impact technology can have on people and the opportunities it provides for people to have greater access to information and services by using modern technology. However, we do have some reservations about some of the language in the bill, some that is there and some that is not there, and I'd like to talk about that for just a moment if I could. We currently, in the Office of Enterprise Technology, our involvement with the languages in reviewing some of the contracts and proposals for new projects that come up, there are provisions within Minnesota law about some of the standards that the witnesses have talked about, not to complete Section 508 or the other federal requirements. but for specific applications, some of those are referenced in the contracts, and vendors are required to comply with those or to certify that they comply with those. We believe that it is possible by modifying the requirements for acquisitions that are currently being administered to achieve many of the obligations that are being placed on OET in this bill. For example, if we required independent certification by another authority, rather than have to independently validate that every purchase that is going to be made of technology has to be examined and certified by OET, we both get within our comfort zone, because we are not experts at that, and we are not resourced to do that, and would not be under this bill, and also would have a higher opportunity for seeing that national standards are imposed on the people that want to do business with the state. We have some concerns that by including in Minnesota statutes the requirements that we comply with federal statutes, when that federal statute has been in place for nearly 40 years and is not being fully complied with now, we create some obligations on the state that we are in no way equipped to handle. There are elements, and by our reading of those federal requirements, that will require us to go back and re-examine our legacy applications in detail and make remediation to those applications, which has a potential cost that is astronomical. And we would like to see some explicit exclusion from those requirements, and would suggest that it's in Minnesota's best interest to selectively choose what we need to do on a priority basis within Minnesota rather than adopt the Section 508 in total, because we simply do not have a way of complying with those. We think that the requirements that we have to individually test those applications, including hardware, for compliance with these standards is a burden we simply cannot meet, and we don't want to have anybody believe that simply increasing the size of our appropriation is going to get us into that situation. Trying to go into all of the thousands of pieces of hardware and software that go into the state's infrastructure and the application bases and everything else we do can be done by OET to independently identify those problems is simply not realistic. So that's why we're trying to say there are better ways of doing this using national authorities and putting the burden on the vendors to comply and then dealing with issues of non-compliance through the normal kinds of processes. By saying that we will affirmatively and proactively enforce these, simply will increase the liability for the state and the opportunities for people to through litigation to get involved. To give you an example, if we have a vendor who brings to the table a piece of software or a piece of hardware that has been certified in other jurisdictions and accepted in other jurisdictions as compliant, and we determine for whatever reason, correctly or incorrectly, it is not compliant, we have simply shut them out of our market in Minnesota for all of the governmental units under our jurisdiction, and we should expect that we would cover litigation for that. If, on the other hand, it turns out we certify something as compliant that is not compliant, and this is where we get into issues of backwards compatibility with technology, so that if our software and hardware is not compatible with every piece of software or hardware that would be used to try to make it accessible, we open ourselves up to litigation from people in the community who are saying, why are you certifying software that is not, or hardware that is not fully compatible? All of these issues can be addressed in the language here by exclusions or inclusions, but we have not had a chance to work on this bill and take a look at what kind of ways might make this more effective. If the language does not exclude explicitly legacy applications in their existing state or modified state, I believe the fiscal note is being prepared. I haven't seen it yet, but we know the cost for trying to do that. Just the assessment is going to run into millions of dollars, because it requires us to look screen by screen and function by function at all of the major software packages and applications in state government, and that frankly is not possible. If it is proactive, we're going forward with new acquisitions of hardware and software and incorporates the modifications of the standards, it becomes doable. And I think our goal should be to be putting into place
legislation that will actually help rather than simply increase frustration with our inability to meet the expectations of this law. It's a good law. The intent is, I think, admirable. As the last witness talked about, there have been tremendous advances in technology in recent years that have made things possible. Were not possible just a few years ago. But creating an impossible standard for us to follow does not make sense. We would also argue that there already is an advisory body in place in the STARS program in the Department of Administration, which deals with the acquisition standards and the accessibility issues for not just blind, deafblind, and hard of hearing, but for all people with disabilities. And to us, it dilutes the impact of that very successful group by saying we're going to separate the technology of disability from the accessibility things that we're trying to put in place. I think the changes to this are good, but they're misguided. This is not about technology exclusively. It is about the acquisition process, and we ought to keep it in that realm. We support the goals of the initiative. We think we can work with the author and with the various stakeholders in this process to come up with better language, given a little time. But we don't think this is the answer. I'll stand for any questions.
Rest of Gala.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Lally, you answered some of the questions that were coming up in the back of my mind about this, and that's, number one, had your department been involved in the creation of the bill? It sounds like there's been a bit of a disconnect in bringing this bill forward, and that concerns me. I think we all agree with the spirit of this bill. I want to vote to move it forward, but I will only do that if I have an understanding that these issues are going to be engaged and dealt with. To simply put forward legislation to say, rah, we did something good for people with disabilities, and then have it be something that doesn't work or kind of shoots us in the foot from your perspective, would not be responsible legislation, I don't think. But Representative Hilty, maybe you can give me some comfort that these issues are going to be addressed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Gottwald, well, obviously there are issues that have to be addressed. The bill has at least two more committees, including my own, to visit. I think we have time to deal with this. This is the first that I have heard from the department. Although the bill was heard in the Senate, some time ago now. Apparently it was a surprise to everyone, so we will be happy to try to resolve any issues that need to be resolved.
Mr. Chairman, in the Senate committee, through, I think nobody afforded an opportunity to testify about this, or we would have made basically the same comments. And we have, I will say, I think I'm late for the table to this discussion. There were discussions with Chief Information Officer Khanna and our Chief Technology Officer Ed Valencia, as well as several other representatives, but they've not been continuous and fully engaging until quite recently. I think we saw the text of this proposal in its early stages a few weeks ago, and just have not been involved in this yet.
Mr. Lally, can you repeat what you said about the Senate? You did not testify in the Senate hearing?
Chairman, that is correct. We did not have an opportunity in the first committee hearing. Bill was presented and the committee voted to advance it, and we did not, I believe through an error, did not get the opportunity to address the group.
So, Mr. Lally, you did not request testimony, or you were denied it? Which was it?
We did not, I think, go through the proper channels to request it. For all my experience up here, I think I blew it. That's why I'm not ascribing any blame to anybody. We will be addressing it this afternoon in Senator Betzel's committee.
All right. Let's then go on.
Now, Mr. Chair, in terms of this kind of bill where we're directing the department to do so much, and that's why I was hoping somebody from your department would be here, we direct so much of this to your area and assign responsibility and accountability and so forth. It's a little surprising to me that a bill like this would come forward without having proactively gone to the department and requested their partnership and input. And it looks like somebody wants to testify to that, but that seems rather surprising to me.
Mr. Lally. Chairman, Representative Scott Wolf, I think that might be explained by the changes that have taken place in recent years in some of the areas of responsibility that formerly were the disposal of the Department of Administration have now evolved, that some of it's ours, some of it's theirs. The boundaries are less significant to us because we work very closely with that department, but it's externally I can understand why that would happen.
Representative Murrow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, Mr. Lally, I have a question for you. You might build a little bit on Representative Gottwald. I'm concerned for the folks in here. If I get this correct, please let me know. About 40 years of federal regulation, we're in no way equipped to follow. There are astronomical costs. We'd have to set a priority list in order to address legacy applications. I'm not ascribing the 40 years of backup or failure to comply to you, but I do think we need a little bit more explanation. Why is the state of Minnesota so far behind on these, what you call, legacy applications?
Mr. Lally.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, initially those federal requirements applied only to the federal programs. There are some programs within state government that are affected by those. The Department of Human Services has some, and they do attempt to observe those guidelines. So the rest of them have not been required of state agencies or, in many cases, anybody other than the federal agencies involved in those programs. Some of the programs, some of the standards have been voluntarily imposed in our architecture process that we're attempting to create. We do include a lot of those standards built into the state's information architecture. But again, those don't apply retroactively to systems that are now 25 years old in some cases. So it hasn't applied to the state. It adds expense that people always have tried to avoid. And we are where we are then, right?
Mr. Chair, thank you. So I want that last statement. It adds expense to comply. I'm worried about what Representative Westrum, for example, was describing earlier about the ability to access state of Minnesota information. And so I'm concerned when I hear, well, the expense to comply is the problem.
Mr. Lally.
Chairman, Representative, the expense lies in trying to modify the existing applications and hardware and software, not in creating the new applications. Much of what we do now is web-based. And the web tags that go with illustrations, for example, can alleviate many of the problems, but in some cases, the going back into an existing site and recoding it is difficult. Some cases, it's not. There are technologies that now enable us to do some of that. There is also the unfortunate reality that in the rush to embrace graphics as a means of effective communication with the majority of our population, we have excluded other parts of our population. The reports that you get routinely from agencies in paper form, I expect, include a great many graphical representations because it's a good way to get a lot of information across and get the message across efficiently. But if you can't see those graphics, there has to be an alternative way of describing it that is very difficult to go back and put in retroactively.
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Lally, I'm just trying to understand in the context of the bill your opposition in terms of the burden on the agency. I'm looking at lines 6.15 and 6.16, and this same language appears elsewhere, but this is just the one that caught my eye, where it basically says that the definition of accessibility and accessible means the standards adopted by rule, and you control that process. If you look at line 3.19 on through 3.27, which is really kind of the guts of the rulemaking mandate here, it basically says your agency shall adopt the rules, and it seems to me gives you a lot of flexibility. Now, it says you have to adopt Section 508 of the Rehabilitation Act and then the other statutory citations. Is that kind of what forms your opposition, that those standards need the exemptions and exclusions that you're talking about? I'm just trying to follow the opposition.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Simon, we don't know necessarily what the interpretation of the statute will be in the future, so we're going by what we see here, which requires us to adopt the federal package. And that federal package, as the last witness talked about, can be interpreted to mean going back into all these legacy applications. There are other components within those chapters that may or may not be applicable, and we don't know that, because we're not experts in this, but we think it would be smart for us to control our own destiny in Minnesota and not dependent on changes in the legislation, which I believe dates back to the 1970s. And we would like to be sure of what we're doing before we embark on this journey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But Mr. Lally, as I read it, though, the only thing you have to adopt ends in 1998. It then says, starting on line 3.25, that as the subsequent revisions to those statutes, you may adopt rules, not shall, but may, incorporating the revisions. So, unless I'm misreading it, and correct me if I'm wrong, it's true that there's a mandate here to adopt what existed as of 1998. But anything thereafter, which I interpret to be these revisions, that's really discretionary.
Representative Simon, I hope that's correct, but I don't know how that's going to be interpreted, as Mr. Jacobson talked about, when we get into a partly situation. We're looking simply for explicit instructions about what we're supposed to do, because it makes just a huge difference in the impact of this. This is a significant, even if it's least impactful, is a significant expansion of our set of responsibilities in an area that we don't have a lot of expertise for. And right now, the way the bill is structured, we're going to get one mid-level technician to enforce all of this and support it. And I don't know somebody that's that good that we're going to get.
Ms. Hartnett, did you want to respond to this?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, there are 18 states that have adopted these standards, and no lawsuits have been have arisen in any of the states. We have in the back... the back section says Oklahoma documents and financial information related to implementation of accessibility standards. They've adopted 508 and WCAG. There's a fiscal impact statement 4 years after implementation of adoption of these rules. It says that the committee itself has zero fiscal impact. We asked specific questions about the cost of implementation. They said that those costs were absorbed. And again, Representative Simon said that a lot of this will go into rulemaking, that the Office of Enterprise Technology will be sitting at the table, will help to determine what the rules are, what elements of 508 and WCAG will be incorporated into the rulemaking. The cornerstone of 508 is to do all of this without causing an undue burden to the state. That's covered throughout 508. So all of these things will be considered without causing an undue burden, an undue hardship to the state. So that's the charge of the committee, and that's the intent.
Representative Connie.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Lally, do you think this would be a better structure if this committee was advisory to STARS instead of kind of the other way around? Was incorporated as a subcommittee of STARS.
Madam Chair, Representative Fon, I'm very proud of what the STARS group has done for the state. I think we can leverage that expertise by bringing this component of it to that same group, so the integration is better, and we don't have issues of who's going to be responsible for what and who's accountable for what. That would be my recommendation.
At some time.
And, Mr. Chairman, I guess I'd also interested in this, particularly since we're talking about some massive reformation of our data information system, the idea of fixing legacy systems that we're going to replace in the next couple of years doesn't seem to make a lot of sense to me. Is there some language you could suggest that would put an element of judgment into what direction we moved on that?
Madam Chair, I've just gone off the top of my head. I could not, but I would like the opportunity to work with Ms. Hartnett and others to try to do that. I appreciate her comments, but my understanding from people in the community is that this law goes further than most of the other states, and we don't know all the implications of it yet, but we have to be nervous about it.
Ms. Hartnett.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, we are in the process of trying to prepare an amendment for this afternoon session that will address our intent to address that issue. Our intent is about moving forward and not fixing anything backwards. And so it's been very busy for Senate counsel. We've been trying to work with him since Friday, and he got something to me at 9 o'clock last night. So we weren't able to respond to it. So we're hoping to look at that language, and we'll show it to to OEP, and hope we can work together to
So, Mr. Chair, there's a hearing on, in the Senate on this bill this afternoon.
Here, that's correct, in government finance.
And there's an amendment being drafted for these concerns?
Mr. Chair, for that one specific concern addressing the legacy issue, yes, that's correct.
Members, I have a long list here, and I'm going to proceed. Representative Kalin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Lally, there, some of the discussion has focused on the legacy application issue, but you did make a statement that I want to make sure that we deal with it head on, and that was that we don't want to discourage proposals or contractors from applying to Minnesota because they can't comply with, or competing in Minnesota because they can't comply. I'm paraphrasing here, but because they can't meet the standards, or that it may be more expensive. And I would just suggest that, I believe in the need to invest in and continue to develop our digital infrastructure, but we would not allow an architect or a planning firm or an engineering firm to bid on a project in Minnesota that could not comply with the ADA. And I think that it is one of the cases where adopting the standards and joining other states will help to move the industry to do what we know needs to happen. Secondly, you referenced the funding is that, you know, could help pay for one mid-level technician. These standards in this and the principles need to go beyond programmatic funding. They need to be an ethic of the construction of infrastructure, and it needs to start with Mr. Khanna, who I know gets the issue, and it needs to start with you, who I know gets the issue. And I understand the concern about cost and implementation, but it is an ethic, and it's about having one standard that can be done as sort of a plug and play in each application and each coding, so that we don't have different competing ways of interpreting existing mandates in existing direction. And I just really hope that this is a pervasive part of the culture at OET, that it won't just be assigned to somebody to sort of be the web accessibility person.
Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Lally.
If I may, the first reference, I believe, was in response to the concern that if we have different ways of determining this eligibility, we may discourage people because of the uncertainty of whether they will be considered in Minnesota to be achieving a different standard than in other states. It's the chilling effect of not on our desire to award contracts to people who don't follow the standards. We would not do that for anything else, architecture or anything else, and we should not do it for this. I absolutely agree with your comments about the need to include this in your word was the ethic. We call it the architecture, the standards that govern what we build and how we build it and how it's presented and how it serves people. So I think we have no dispute over any of that.
Representative Kissmeyer.
My questions have been addressed. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Gutwald. Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, this is to either testifier. Mr. Lally, you talked about requiring outside certification on the part of the vendors rather than assigning that responsibility to OET. And it's my experience that Section 508 has, I think, four or five levels of compliance. Mm-hmm. Couldn't we just adopt a rule saying that going forward, any new application has to meet a certain standard of 508 compliance and then require the vendor to provide the certification from an outside firm that they've met that?
Mr. Chairman,
Lally.
Representative Winkler, we do that in some other areas already. The issue is we have, in this language as we read it, we have the obligation whether or not that certification is correct or not. Right now, in many areas, in terms of their labor practices and so on, contractors are required to certify that they follow certain practices in labor law. We can't verify that preemptively on all the contracts. We can only address it if it's brought to our attention after a contract's in place and their behavior is appropriate. It's just the magnitude of what that would involve if it concerns us.
Representative Winkler. Ms. Hartnett.
Mr. Chair, Representative Winkler, Actually, we asked how Oklahoma does it, which is considered to be, as I said, the gold standard in the country. And they basically have that list that was determined by the advisory comparable advisory committee, and then they have to write into the contract and say, yes, they have complied with these pieces, and then they have a group that is just testing it to make sure that it's in compliance, and they don't get paid if they're not in compliance. So basically, the onus is on the contractor, and that's how it's worked, and we hope that the language would reflect that. If there's wording that contradicts that, then we'll certainly work on that to make sure that it occurs. And actually, we have some of the language in the Oklahoma, there's the Central Purchasing Division Information Technology Access Clause that we have in our packet addresses some of those concerns.
Mr. Chair, I just don't think this has to be that hard if they have a chance to sit down and work together, because there are also outside third-party firms that can certify this, just like they do for security. And so if you just make that third-party certification part of the obligation of the contract, it may increase the cost of the system, but at least that can be factored in going forward, and we don't have to have OET develop an entirely sort of new set of expertise on this issue. And I think that third-party certification might be the way to do that.
Ms. Hartnett.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, again, 18 states have adopted 508 and WCAG. WCAG comes from the World Wide Web Consortium, which is the largest consortium of web developers. They've created standards in every other area of the web, and then they developed a set of standards for web content accessibility guidelines, which WCAG stands for. So they are nationally and actually internationally recognized standards that are used and have been applied and used successfully in other states. And I may add that for 2 years we were trying to encourage departments to adopt these standards, so this is not a new discussion, and we gave copies of the draft legislation a couple of months ago to both departments.
Ms. Hartnett, to that point, when you spoke to me about hearing this bill in my office, how long had you said you'd been working on it?
On this particular bill, we were hoping for the standards to be adopted.
No, how long had you been working on the bill?
On the bill. For
when you talked to me in my office, how long did you tell me you'd been working on the bill?
For several months.
And you had just testified that you had given copies of drafts of this to the department?
Emails.
Emails, and were they done the same week you talked to me, or were they done previous to that?
Previous to that.
All right. There seems to be a great deal of confusion here, or lack of communication between the department and your group and almost anyone else who testified today.
Mm-hmm.
So my comfort level with this is not high. And you want to communicate better, hence the legislation is here, yet there seems to be a failure to communicate.
Mm-hmm.
Just an observation to everyone. Anyone else wish to testify on this bill? Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record. We're pressed for time.
Mr. Chairman, members, very quickly, I noticed the A1 amendment, and we had talked to Mary about this as well as Representative Hilty. It's the wrong agency. The way the bill is drafted, it goes to the Department of Administration instead of Office of Enterprise Technology. We can fix it later, but we should probably be on record at least.
We have two A1 amendments. The first A1 amendment we put on, I renamed the second A1 A2. So the long amendment, which I am now calling the A2 amendment, is the one that, Mr. Rhodes, is that the one you're referring to?
Mr. Chairman, remember that.
All right, I'm renaming this one the A2 for clarity. Representative Hilty, to the A2 amendment, which has not been moved. And Mr. Rhodes, you want to clarify again why we need this?
Mr. Chairman, members, the technology is done by OET, as you know, and they have it as Department of Administration. We're great, but we're not that great, and we do work together. Obviously, it was a spin-off a few years ago, and that's probably why the confusion, but it should be in 16E instead of 16C, and as the amendment is drafted.
All right. Representative Hilty, I'm going to have Mr. Shepard respond to this one. Mr. Shepard, can you explain the need for this amendment?
Mr. Chair, members, the A2 amendment does two things. The first half of it, down to through page 1, line 17, does exactly what Mr. Rhodes just said. It transfers the duty to adopt rules from the Department of Administration to the Office of Enterprise Technology, so that the language you see in the amendment, the Chief Information Officer of OET would adopt the rules establishing technology access standards, not the Department of Administration as the bill currently stands. The second half of the amendment, starting on line 18, adds one representative to the Advisory Council and has some other language that deals with the Advisory Council. And finally, it makes the effective date of the bill July 1, 2009, instead of July 1, 2011.
Representative Hilty, let's see the amendment.
My understanding is that this amendment represents the changes that have already been made to the bill in the Senate.
All right. Any further discussion to the amendment? We have one other person who wishes to testify. Please come up. To the amendment, and welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Diane Wells, and I'm the manager of the Telecommunications Division within the Department of Commerce. And my purpose for being here today is limited solely to Section 15 of the bill, which allocates $300,000 per year from the Telecommunications Access Minnesota Fund.
All right, Ms. Wells, we're on the amendment now.
Okay.
So I would like the discussion at this point to be on the motion that's before the body, which is the amendment. So let's stay with the amendment. Any further discussion to this amendment?
Sure, I would move adoption of
the
amendment.
All right. Representative Hilty has moved adoption of the amendment. Any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Now, Ms. Wells, to the bill as amended. And if it's a purely a financial issue, we'll deal with that in finance. If it's a policy issue with rulemaking or technology, we welcome your testimony.
Right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hilty has indicated he will deal with the issue that the Department of Commerce has with Section 15 in his committee.
Representative Hilty.
Mr. Chair, that's been my intention all along. We need to have that discussion. I don't think it's appropriate in this committee.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I apologize. I did leave a voicemail with Representative Hilty and Mr. Mollander yesterday afternoon, and I didn't hear back, so I appeared to testify.
Ms. Wells, there seems to be an ongoing failure of communication. We'll have to correct all of that. I apologize.
And I apologize. Thank you.
Further testimony on the bill as amended. Representative Hilty then renews his motion that House File 1744 as amended be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Finance Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay.
Aye.
Motion prevails. Representative Lilly, House File 1218.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members.
President Lilly, I will move that House File 1218 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Finance Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This morning I was, Phyllis Kahn's inspired me to ride my bike and exercise, so I was riding down the Gateway Trail and I thought of you and Representative Kalin and your committee administrator, and when I got by the par 4 on Keller Golf Course, I was wondering, when you're in a tee box, now do you go over the tree or under the tree? Or are you using 8 or 9 iron? I'm just kind of curious on April 1st, if you could.
Representative, really, to your point, it's usually an 8-iron shot unless the wind is in your face, and otherwise it's a cut 7-iron, but just depends.
Well played, Mr. Chair. To the bill.
Finally.
Wow.
And Representative Lilly, Arnold Palmer took an 11 on that hole in the St. Paul Open, just so you know.
I'm not telling you the numbers that I've obtained.
And I can only imagine. Red Sand Blue, you have an amendment to the bill, and I think we need to put the amendment on to...
Mr. Chair, we could either talk about the bill or add that on. I certainly want to get it in the shape that I want. But
so I think we better put the amendment on, and then you can talk to the bill in totality. So I'm going to move the A2 amendment, and this is out of custom to the author. We'll put the bill in the order he wishes it. So all those in favor of the A2 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. All right, Representative Early, to the bill as amended.
Mr. Chair, I serve on the subcommittee of employee relations and with the esteemed member, Representative Lanning. And during the interim, what we essentially do is we ratify the contracts that are negotiated between the state negotiator and the work group. So most of the contracts are already in place for 2008. During the session, those were put through, and there was a few of them that were still outstanding. So that's essentially what this bill. The reason we were on your agenda about a week ago to have our bill heard, but another contract came in, and so that's what the amendment is. That's for the state university faculty amendment. I have with me today Mr. Hubinger, the director of the Legislative Coordinating Commission, and also is the brains of our subcommittee as well. And maybe he can go through the bill, sir.
Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm Greg Hubinger with the Legislative Coordinating Commission and the Subcommittee on Employee Relations. As Representative Lilly indicated, most of the contracts and plans in this bill that would ratify those plans and contracts are for the current biennium, so there are 6 months left to them, and they've been in effect since last summer and fall. The amendment that was added just a moment ago would ratify the contract with the state university faculty. That's the one contract that would be in effect for the next biennium that begins on July 1. If you'd like to, Mr. Chair, I'd go through the subdivisions briefly just to describe what's in the bill.
Why don't you? Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, members, Subdivision 1 ratifies a contract with the administrative service faculty at MNSCU. Those terms and conditions are similar to the pattern that was established for all of the other contracts and plans. Subdivisions 2 and 3 ratify amendments to the commissioner's plan and the managerial plan on representative employees. The only substantive provision in here was a provision in the commissioner's plan that ratified a salary differential for psychiatrists who work for DHS. Subdivisions 4, 5, and 6 ratify salary increases for the directors of the three statewide pension funds. Those three plans had compensation studies done last year that found that they were substantially under market, and as a result, the subcommittee approved proposals by the three boards of those funds to increase those director salaries by 12%. Subdivision 7 would ratify a compensation plan for the State Board of Investment. That board also had a compensation study done for their unrepresented staff. There are about 12 of them that work for the Board of Investment, and found that those employees were also substantially under market when compared to other public pension plan, State Board of Investments in the country. And as a result, those salary ranges and salaries were increased by between 25 and 45%. Subdivision 8 would ratify an arbitration award for the Minnesota Nurses Association. The arbitrator awarded the state pattern of 3.25% across-the-board increases, but also awarded some language that the Nurses Association had been seeking regarding the assignment of overtime. And Subdivision 9 would ratify a compensation plan, a new plan for the legislative auditor. That plan went into effect January 1st, about 3 months ago, and is similar to a plan that the Legislative Coordinating Commission has for its employees.
And then the IFO contract?
Mr. Chair, that amendment, again, is for the contract that would go into effect on July 1st for the State University faculty. That contract provides for faculty to have retain their current salaries. There will be no steps, no across-the-board increases.
Mr. Hubinger, let's stay with that one for a second. You testified that this is a 0% increase in this contract?
Mr. Chair, those faculty will not receive across-the-board or lane changes or steps. Faculty that are eligible for seniority increases at the 10, 20, and 30-year point will continue to receive them. They will continue to receive what's in their base contract for early retirement incentives and professional improvement.
So the cost to the state, considering the internal changes in the contract, would be what? Would it be zero, or would it be 1% or 2%, or what would it be?
I believe that the cost of that contract was essentially the increased cost of health insurance for employees, which is projected to increase 6% each year.
All right. First thing, Gutwald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Lilly, or the testifier, I'm curious. I know this ratifies bargaining, and I'm curious to know what kind of bargaining we got. What did the state get in the way of concessions? I know for the current biennium, we're sitting at about $6.5 billion in employee contracts of this kind, the state-negotiated contracts, and my understanding is this bill adds to that for the current biennium, but I am curious about the bargaining process that we're ratifying under this contract.
Representative Lee?
Mr. Chair and Representative, this is, negotiated with, the governor's team, essentially, and so your team, and so hopefully you're happy with it. No, that's
not.
I think I'll pass.
All right. Mr. Huebinger.
Apparently not everybody agrees with the governor.
Mr. Huebinger, contracts are contracts, and we don't abrogate a contract, but considering the financial situation that we're here, when we put the money on the table for these contracts, whatever percentages you have here will be decided in what way? X amount of money, despite the percentage increase, translates into what? If we say that there is just this much money on the table, and you have, and I just wrote down a couple of the percentage increases, what happens?
Mr. Chair and members, agencies and MNSCU negotiate these contracts, and the organizations have to absorb the cost of these contracts within their existing budget. In the current biennium, in the 07 session, there was a salary supplement basically provided at 3% per year, and the contracts cost somewhat more than that, and the agencies had to absorb the costs of those increases.
And those absorptions are done primarily how?
For the costs of the contracts that exceed the amount that was appropriated, then they either have to rely on vacancies or turnover savings or reducing other lines in their budget.
All right, just so it's clear to everyone that whatever percentage increase may be in these budgets, when we put the money out there, they'll address that increase, and they have to do it in that manner. They'll either be, vacancies will not be filled, or they will be cut, and that's the discussion that's going on now across the state agencies. So, further discussion. Seeing no further discussion, I'll renew my motion that House File 1218 as amended be recommended to pass and be referred to the Finance Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Representative Nelson. And you have a division report, Representative Nelson?
Yes.
You want to move the division report?
I'll move the division report, Mr. Chair.
Representative Nelson, move the division report. Any discussion? Seeing no discussion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay? Motion prevails. Representative Nelson, two-year bill, House File 1849.
I'd like to move 1849 to be passed and referred to the Committee on Finance.
All right. Two-year bill.
And, Mr. Chair, I have an amendment that, and I apologize for this, but I have an amendment of the A3 amendments you should have. And so what the A3 amendment does is, this was originally Section 3 of the bill, 1849 bill, and we took it out because there were some concerns about it. We got it with the ALJs, the counties, League of Minnesota Cities came forward and said they needed this part of it put back in. They were willing to put this part back in, and it's just all it does is the section two, or the first section of this bill, all it does is it changes counties to jurisdiction in which the election was held. And that's the only thing that part does. The other part in the repealer, we're taking one part out of the repealer that was in the original bill that dealt with the wealthy bill that we passed out of here. This repealer will repeal the travel policies for these local jurisdictions,
And the Wealthy's Bill, I think, is a better way of doing it. It's, they have to have a travel policy, but they don't have to look at it on an annual basis. And I think that's a better solution. So we're taking that repealer out of the bill.
All right. Discussion to the amendment. Anyone wish to testify on the amendment? All right. Seeing none, Representative Nelson moves the A3 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Nelson, two-year bill as amended.
1849 is basically the mandate reduction bill. It incorporates the stuff that came out of the Senate version of this bill that was being carried by Senator Rest. There was no House or Senate companion to 1195, and this is trying to take in the portions of 1195 that we passed out of this committee, and a couple other things that were in the Senate bill, and there's a couple pieces here that came to us afterwards. Representative Doty had an amendment and had a bill, and Senator Pop, or Representative Poppy approached me and about allowing counties to reduce the ability to reduce their salaries, and that's in section 7 and 10 of the bill. And the other parts that were in Senate bill had to do with annual reported increases on building construction, increasing from $5,000 to $10,000, the cap or the threshold where they had to report these, the thin sewer provisions in there, the public public burial grounds that have been taken over by the towns and the counties are in here. The provisions in here have to do with the minimum salaries of county auditors, treasurers, recorders, sheriffs, and it takes the minimum out of that that's in statute, and for counties under 75,000, and at least the procedure's in there, but there's nobody right now working in those under those or close to those minimums, but it gives the counties more flexibility in their salaries. There's section 17 through 19 deal with advertisers for bids and threshold for contract amounts, and it takes it out of the statute section that it's in and just references the municipal uniform municipal contracting law in another section of the state statute. The metropolitan counties added a note in Dakota to counties that follow a different procedure, that the same procedures that Hennepin and Ramsey County currently fall for the Met Council. Look in 1195, section 21 had removed the $10 cap on booking fees for the counties, and then the repealers are there again, and the repealers deal with, again, the minimum salaries for counties for those positions that I already stated.
Discussion to the Representative Marquardt.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Representative Nelson, one area on the minimum requirements for salaries for sheriffs and so forth, and I realize, you know, $6,000, $7,000 was probably not that low, but my concern is if a county board got in a disagreement with a sheriff and said, we're going to pay you $5,000, what recourse does a sheriff or any of these elected county officials have as far as salaries? Do they have a board they can go to?
There's an appeals board that's in the statute. Mr. Chair, there's an appeals board that's in the statute.
Mm-hmm. Any further discussion to the bill as amended? Yeah. Anyone wish to testify for or against the bill? All right. Seeing none, then Representative Nelson renews his motion that House File 1849 as amended be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Finance Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Representative Tamar, I know, has been waiting. Is he still here? I thought I saw him. We're going to get in. Representative Poppy.
Mr. Chair, I move the minutes of March 31st.
Representative Poppy moves the minutes. Any discussion? Seeing no discussion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Representative Tamar, I'm going to move that House File 1268 be recommended to pass, and I'm told it's to be re-referred to civil justice.
Mr. Chair, that's what I understand, because
And because of the liability provision in here, as I understand.
All right, I thought maybe fitness might be a crime in the state capital.
Not yet.
Not yet. All right, Greg Kramer, to your bill. And I will move House File 1268 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to civil justice.
Mr. Chair, I'll be very brief. I know you've had a long morning. This bill basically does three things. It allows state employees of the executive, legislative, and judicial branch to use the Capitol complex for fitness and wellness classes or activities. It permits a participation fee to be paid to an instructor for the facilitation of these classes. And it includes standard language waiving any claims of liability against the state for damages or injury resulting from the use of the space for these classes or activities. This bill came to me from staff here in the state office building, and I think it's a good idea, and it promotes healthy lifestyles and perhaps can save the state some money and reduce some of the tension in this place.
Is it compulsory for all legislators, particularly the authors?
Representative Taylor.
Who are the other authors? I don't know, actually.
Eastland, Linker, Poppy, and Diskins.
We'd like to start a yoga class.
Mr. Rhodes is here. The department supports the bill, Mr. Chair.
All right, so is there anyone that wishes to testify for or against the bill? All right, seeing none, then I'll renew my motion that House File 1268 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to civil justice. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Meeting is adjourned.